month later.
Okay, can I start Sunday school? We're gonna stand here. Well, thank you all for coming. This is a wonderful turnout on a snowy day. Today is Sunday, March the 3rd, right, 2013, and we're at 10:01 a.m., and as you all know, I love to start on time, and so I thank you for permitting me to do so. You may recall that our subject for the sequence we're doing now is Plutarch's Lives. And Plutarch was a Greek. He was born in 45 A.D. and died in 120 A.D. He was a very wealthy man, and he lived during one of the greatest periods of Roman history. He was alive during the period of the five good emperors, or the five great emperors. The five great emperors were Nerva, who only had a two-year reign, but then Trajan, who was in office for 20 years, and he was the emperor who was the emperor while Plutarch spent the last 20 years of his life. So presumably Plutarch wrote the bulk of his work from his 40th, in the last 20 years of his life, because people normally come to adulthood and power and have that power during the latter part of their life. The other five, the rest of the emperors were Hadrian, who was a 20-year reign, Antoninus Pius, a 23-year reign, and then Marcus Aurelius, who was famous for the book called The Meditations, which is a Stoic tome, was the emperor after that. So these were the five great, the good emperors of Rome, and Plutarch was in that period of time. Plutarch is famous mostly for his parallel lives, which are a series of 23 parallel lives adding up to 46 lives. This book is taught as part of the liberal arts curriculum at St. John's College, for example, and most serious liberal arts colleges do teach Plutarch's Lives. This book has influenced many, many people, that is, Plutarch's Lives have, and it's a great, great work, and I am honored to be allowed to talk to you about it today. Now, we've already talked about several lives, and the parallel life with Coriolanus, who we're doing today, is Alcibiades, what we did last month. And so, at the end of my talk today, what I'm going to do is I'm going to refer to the essay which Plutarch writes at the end of all the parallel lives, in which he makes some comparison between the two the two parallel lives, the Roman and the Greek life, and draw some moral conclusions about them. Now, Coriolanus is maybe familiar to us because it is a famous play of Shakespeare. And Shakespeare drew very, very heavily from this work. In fact, I haven't done the comparison, but I wouldn't be surprised if the mother's speech to Coriolanus, which I hope to have time to read to you today, it's only about a half a page, but is a very famous speech, and it is in the play of Shakespeare. And that's how I came to this particular work, is that I saw Coriolanus the movie, which was just done in 2011, and it was, I thought, a marvelous movie. And so I immediately picked up the parallel lives and read it and was shocked at the similarities. So Shakespeare's play was done between 1605 and 1608. The time exact is not nailed down. Some famous people who have portrayed Coriolanus include Laurence Olivier in 1937 and Richard Burton did the play as Coriolanus. And then, of course, the film that I've already mentioned was done. Albert Finney, the picture I have up here from the movie, shows Coriolanus, I think, on the left. That's Albert Finney, and Gerard Butler on the right is Tullus Aphidius, who is the Volscian general, and these two play an important role in this activity. In the movie, Vanessa Redgrave plays Volumnia, who is the mother of Coriolanus, and she, of course, is very important, and she has a major speech in the thing. Now, this is supposedly a true story. This is a history. This is a biography of Coriolanus. And it comes during the time of the Roman wars with the Volscians, which was around 1494. I mean, there was a series of war over many years, but the center point that we can identify is the date of 1494, because that is the year which history tells us that the office of the tribune was created, and a certain category of sort of police officers called the aediles, A-E-D-I-L-E-S, was created to defend the people of Rome, and this fact plays a role in the history, in the biography that we have here of Coriolanus. Now, I wanted to let you, I always like to know where things happen, and so what I've done is I've taken some pictures of Italy. I have a more or less modern picture of Italy over there, and then a less modern picture, which in this green area demonstrates where the Volscians lived. And essentially, it's just north of Naples. You can't really tell from what you're looking at. But this hill here corresponds to that hill there. Straight across over here is the Bay of Naples, and the Volscians are right here, and Rome is up there. So they're just down the coast. That is, the Volscians are just down the coast from Rome. So they're in very close proximity. And obviously, in the 5th century, Rome was not the empire at that time, and so they were, well, they've always, I suppose they were always in constant war, but they were in lots of wars with all, with their neighbors. And it is the war with their neighbors that is interesting here, the war with the Volscians. So now let me turn to the actual material that Plutarch gives us on Coriolanus. Now, Coriolanus is not the man's name in the sense that this is not the name that he was born with. It was the habit of people of this time to name people after some common feature. Like you had people that had a big mole on their lip or something, and I think, who was it that had a big mole on his lip? I don't remember, one of the people we studied. But a great king of or leader of Greece had a big head. Had a big head, and so that he had a big head.
Are you telling us that Coriolanus had a standout feature that they named him after?
He did. But well, I'm going to tell you what the standout feature was. But the feature could be many things. It could be a fast runner. It could be had a wart on his nose. It could be had a big head. Cephalus, for example, that we know from Plato, that means simply big head. And so people had a sort of a nickname, and Coriolanus happens to be his nickname. His real name was Gaius Marcius, and he was born to a very wealthy family, but his father died very young, and it's going to turn out, I think, that that's extremely important in his life, that he was raised by his mother. He trained from youth very vigorously, and apparently he was unbeatable in any physical activity. You know, he was like Arnold Schwarzenegger or something, I suppose. In his first battle, when he was only a boy, it was called the Battle of Regulus in 498 BC, he saved a fellow citizen of Rome, and he got his first oak garland around his head. And after that, he was really pleased that he had those great accolades, and so he was really enthusiastic about repeating himself and continuing to be a big success in battle. Now, as I said, he was raised by his mother, but I would like to say that he was a mama's boy, because his mother never remarried, and he always lived with his mother. His mother actually got his, you know, lined up the wife that she found to be satisfactory, and even after the wife bore him children, he still stayed in mom's basement watching video games. I'm kidding. He still stayed with his mom, with his wife in the house, and his kids, and so mom was always, always there. Now, during this time period in Rome, there was great political conflict between the rich people, the patricians, and the poor people, the plebeians. And the patricians were largely represented by the Senate, and the poor people were poor people. And there was a problem of debts. The poor people were being jailed for. And put into debtor's prison, the people who were in the middle class were having their property confiscated. You know, the details of how they came into debt to the patricians is not exactly clear. But nevertheless, there was an enormous conflict between the rich people and the common people. And Marius was one who sided with the Senate. And so he was on the rich people's side. Now, as a part of this dispute, the people decided that they were just going to leave town. And so all the common people got up and walked out of town and went to a hill about 3 miles from the city. And this caused a great deal of problem because obviously the poor people, I suppose, and the middle class people were what supported the rich people. At least that's the theory of Plutarch here. And so the Senate was upset. And the spokesperson for the Senate went out to these people and he tried to reason with them very very reasonably, and he likened the Senate to the stomach. He made a metaphor, and he said, look people, you know, we know that all we do is, you know, consume food, and that all you work to feed us. But the person who was arguing for the Senate said, the stomach does, you know, it processes stuff and it returns good back to the body. So you know, we perform a vital function too. We're the thought processes. We make important decisions, and so you ought to support us. Well, they actually reached a settlement, but part of the settlement was the creation of the office of tribune, which was done in 494 BC, as I mentioned. Now there were 5 tribunes, and they were the protectors of the people. So they would, as tribunes, if they needed to defend a common person, they had lots of power and acted in the defense of the common people. They had a category of police officer, which I already mentioned, called aediles, which enforced their rules. Okay, so as I mentioned, we're having a big war with the Volscians, and there was a city named Corioli, related to Coriolanus, so we're going to find out what that's all about, that was part of this one of these battles with the Romans versus the Volscians. So they wanted to capture this important city of Corioli, and they laid siege to it. And so they were sieging the city, and they were also doing battle. There were 2 fronts, basically. They were laying siege to this city, and they were also engaging in battle with the army of that town, not necessarily in siege with it. So the people in the city were confident of themselves, and so what they did is they sortied out of the city to go make an attack on the Roman soldiers, and Marius saw this as an opportunity. And so he took a small band of soldiers and basically invaded the city personally. And the description is fairly vivid in the text, but if you see the movie, it's a very violent and bloody scene where he, you know, at the cost of great blood for his companions and himself, goes into the city and participates in overcoming the city. It's interesting because those of you who heard Alcibiades last month, he did the same kind of thing. You know, he would go into these cities, and there was on one occasion, we talked about this last week, where Alcibiades broke into a city up near the Hellespont. He was basically standing there alone, and the massive army of the citizens are standing before him ready to destroy him, and he said, stop, I arrest you in the name of the law. And of course everybody laid down their arms to Alcibiades. So there's a parallel in the facts here too. But anyway, Coriolanus was very successful on this occasion, and he defeated the city of Corioli, whatever it is. And the Romans began to loot the city. And he said, no, people, no, we still have another front, so stop this looting. You know, you're just using that as an excuse not to engage in battle with the main army, which is still out in the field. And so he took another small band. He said, you know, you got some of the people to come out, stop the looting and the pillaging, which is fun, I suppose. And he went and he raised Cain with the other part, and he defeated the whole army. So he was like this one-man berserker. You know what a berserker is? The old Norse story about the guy who's just a madman in battle. And so he's a madman in battle and takes the city, and then he continues his madman in battle and succeeds in assisting the main body of the Roman army defeat the main body of the Volscian army. And so he's greatly, everybody's really impressed with this. And so the leader, the consul who's leading this battle says, okay, because you, Gaius Marcius, have been so successful here, I'm going to give you 1/10 of all the booty from the whole battle, which obviously would have been a lot of money. And Coriolanus says, no, you know, I'll just take my thermos. I'll just take this horse. That's all I want. Plus, I want to have a friend of mine who is a Volsatian, is now captured and lost all his property, and he's going to be sold into slavery, but I want you to let my friend not be sold into slavery. So very honorable, really. You know, I'm not going to take a reward special from the other, but I'm just going to take my fair share with the army. All I want is this horse, and I want you to not sell my friend into slavery, who is a member of that country. So everybody was extremely impressed with his nobility, his honor, and his courage. But they decided, okay, well, what we're going to do, though, is we're going to name you Coriolanus after the city which you have participated so effectively in defeating. And so that's where his name Coriolanus comes from. Okay, so he's now a very big man in the city. And goes back to the city, but still there's this conflict going on between the rich people and the poor people. That has not been solved. And at this time, another city not related to Corioli comes and says, look, we've lost 90% of our population to the plague, and what we want you to do is take over our city. We give you the city, and we want you to send colonists there. So the Senate sees this as a great opportunity to get rid of rabble-rousers, you know, the poor people who are rabble-rousing, and so they want to send these people to the city. Well, of course, the tribunes are very suspicious of this. They say, why do you want to send our people to a plague-ridden city where their dead bodies piled up in mounds and where the gods of the city obviously don't like it very much because they killed 90% of the people? And so they refuse to obey the order to go to the city. Well, Gaius Marius Coriolanus comes to the defense of the Senate, and he basically forces the people out. He uses his power to force people out. And they do a good job in the movie of showing these kinds of scenes where Coriolanus just stands right up in the face of the mob. I mean, he's just standing there in the face of the mob, soul, and says, you know, you people, you poor, sorry people, you know, do what you're supposed to do. And he's not at all apologetic about it. Coriolanus leads a raid against Antium, A-N-T-I-U-M, which is a Volsatian city, during this period of time, and seizes a lot of prisoners and cattle. And because he's so famous, he's had all these big successes, including this most recent attacking the city of Antium, he decides that he wants to run for consul, which is a big job in the Roman Empire, Roman Republic at this time. And so he does. But the problem is that he is not a very humble man, and he doesn't get along very well with people. And in order to get elected consul, what you have to do is you have to go out in the city, wear a very humble dress, no tunic, but a toga. So he's only wearing a toga. And the point is to show that you don't have pockets where you're getting money being hidden and things like that. And also you get to show your scars. He said, I've got a big one here, you know. I got a really bad one over here. And so he has 17 years of scars to show the people. And they're all pretty impressed with him. But unfortunately, you know, the tribunes interfered and, you know, said he just wants to take over the city because he's so popular. And he actually lost the election. He just simply lost the election, which doesn't sound like the end of the world. But for Coriolanus, it wasn't very good. So here's what Plutarch says about that. Gaius Marius revealed that he was quite incapable of patience or self-control when faced with a reverse. He had always given free rein to the impulses of pride and aggression in his nature, as if there were some inherent grandeur and nobility in these qualities, and had never allowed himself to be ruled by reason and discipline so as to develop the combination of gravity and tolerance which is so indispensable for a statesman. He never understood that a man who aspires to play a part in public affairs must avoid above all things that have a tendency to self-assertion. And so, you know, he was just rude, and that didn't go over well. And at this time, after having lost the consulship, it happened that there was a big delivery of grain, which had been purchased around Italy, but also was in part a gift from the tyrant of Syracuse. And it's interesting because Syracuse on Sicily, you know, appears again and again. In fact, we just had a story about Alcibiades last month, talking, dealing with Syracuse and all that stuff. But anyway, so Syracuse is involved again, and they've made this great gift of grain to Rome. Now, the people are really happy because they're, you know, things have been bad. The poor people have not been eating well, and they've been worried about their debts. And so they're figuring this great gift of grain is going to result in the price of grain coming down generally, plus they'll get a free gift of the money. The stuff that's come in will be given to the people. Well, you know, what happened is that Marius opposes that, you know. He's just not a big fan of the people, and he thinks they ought to, you know, put their backs to the grindstone and work, 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 and pay their debts. You know, he's just a good Republican, right? So, he opposes this. Now, the tribunes see him opposing it in the Senate, and seeing that Marius is about to win with the Senate as far as his grain is concerned, and so the tribunes go out among the people and they say, you know, there goes Marius again, he's making a scene, doing bad things. And so the tribunes charge him with a crime, and I don't know what crime it is, but and they send their police officers, the aediles, in there to arrest him right out of the Senate. And there's a big fight. Now, this is not a good thing. So we have the aediles, and it's bad to hit, and the aediles are hit, actually struck. And obviously, and apparently that's a huge offense to hit the official police guys. And so we have a problem. The Senate's worried, but they soften, and actually, and essentially, basically, the tribune sentenced Coriolanus to death. Now, this is a problem because the patricians don't want one of their own to be executed. That's not a good thing. And so, but they try to work it out, and they say, "Well, okay, we'll set a trial, and we'll set the trial 3 market days hence, which because there's 9 days between market days, there's 27 days hence, and you know they're sort of putting it off." Now, during that period of time, Rome was attacked again by the city of Antium, and so the senators are saying, "Well, gee, maybe we'll luck out here, and we'll never have to deal with it." But no luck. And he has to go to trial. And he basically says, you know, I Coriolanus says, you know, I'll volunteer for trial, but state the charge in advance. Let me know what the conditions are, what I'm charged with, and, you know, and the terms, how it's going to be voted for. And so they do that, but when they get to the court, which is just, you know, basically the rabble, they change the charges, modify the charges, modify the method of finding him guilty or not, so that he... he's not. They don't meet their conditions. And they find him guilty of whatever crime it was he's charged with doing. But they don't execute him. They order that he be abandoned. And he walks out of the city with nothing. I mean, he leaves everything behind. I mean, he probably takes his wife and children, but he walks out without anything. And he's very, very... he's very, very mad. And let me just read the description that Plutarch gives of this scene. But this apparent composure was based neither upon logic, equanimity, nor any intention of enduring his fate meekly. It was the product of a concentrated fury and indignation, which, although this is not generally understood, it is really an expression of intense pain. For when grief turns to anger, it is devoured, so to speak, by the flame which it generates, and any notion of humility or passive acceptance is utterly worn out. And so, just as a sick man seeks to burn with fever, so the angry man seems to be full of energy because he is suffering from a kind of inflammation, a swelling and a throbbing of the spirit. This was Marcius' state of mind, as was soon made apparent by his action. So he's walking out of the city with nothing. This was a great picture. I love in the movie, it's really great, because he doesn't walk out with his family in the movie, he just walks out. And so he's... and so he says to himself, well, I'll go over to the Volscians. And of course, this is paralleled with Alcibiades, who, when he had difficulties, he went over to the Spartans. So that's a parallel here. Now, he's not a very popular guy because with the Volscians either, because he's killed thousands of them, you know, in war, and he's, you know, very famous for killing those people. And so he basically walks over to Antium, which is the city that we've had all these battles with recently. And there happens to be a particular guy named Tullus Aufidius, who is pictured there on the right in his acting character here, who is the big cheese, the guy that really, really, really hates Coriolanus. They've been, you know, when they're in battle, they would yell across the lines to each other and say, you know, bad things to one another, and so they were primary enemies. So Coriolanus basically sneaks into the city because he's dressed in, you know, clothes that he's not recognized, and he actually steals into the house of Tullus Aufidius, and he hides by the hearth. Now apparently that's the way you seek shelter in a house and not get killed, because the hearth is the place where the gods are, the gods of the home are. And so if you want to go into somebody's house and seek refuge, you do so by the hearth, and you're not attacked. So the servants see this guy, you know, huddling there beside the hearth, and they tell Tullus Aufidius says what's going on here, and then he comes in there and he sees Coriolanus. And I'm not going to read the text because we don't have enough time to do it, but Coriolanus basically says, you know, look, I'm here to help you. You know, if you don't want my help, just kill me, because my life is worthless anyway in that event. And so, but he says, no, he says, you're my friend. I welcome you into my home, and I'm glad to have you as my ally. So, this guy, Aufidius and Coriolanus, immediately start planning the next war with Rome. Now that's somewhat of a problem, because the city of Antium and the city of Rome have just concluded, because they just had a battle like 30 days ago, they just concluded a truce which was good for 2 years. And so they try to figure out a way to undermine that. And of course this is parallel to something that Alcibiades did when he undermined the ambassadors coming from Sparta to Athens who had arranged this peace, and he said to them, you know, you need to change your story, remember this, and he said to the ambassadors, tell them you don't have primary authority, that you can't make the decision, that you have to send it back home to get verification before we act. And Alcibiades basically screwed that up. So this parallel activity here for Coriolanus and Aufidius is that they start up a war with the Romans. Now the first attack that Coriolanus makes is upon the ground around Rome, and what he does intentionally is he spares all the land of the nobles. So he goes out there and wrecks the middle class and the poor people's property. And his intention was to cause dissension in Rome. I mean, obviously you had this big battle between the plebeians and the patricians anyway. And now the plebeians have had their property destroyed, and the patricians have been protected. And he only did it to create, you know, the political confusion. And of course, he's very successful in that. And that's not a pretty picture. Now, he does a lot of campaigning around Rome, and just to indicate how bad it is, he invades and captures a city called Bola, which is about 12 miles from Rome, and he kills every adult in the place. I mean, he is not a happy camper, and obviously not a very good man in this sense. Rome is in political disorder because of all this, but Italy is amazed with the power of Coriolanus and his amazing successes. So the people then decide, well, gee, you know, we made a mistake by banishing our friend Coriolanus, and so let's not do it. But the Senate now has a backup too, because they've been insulted, and they say no. Coriolanus hears about it, and so Coriolanus immediately lifts his troops up and goes lay siege to Rome. They send out, the Senate changes its mind when Coriolanus surrounds Rome, and so they send out a delegation to try to persuade him, Coriolanus, to come back to the city. You know, we forgive you, we're sorry, and all this stuff. But he responds bitterly, but he nevertheless does withdraw, because they've come out and made this promise. And this doesn't sit well with the Volscians generally, that they've got this advantage, they're ready to invade Rome, and they're not happy about that. But, you know, he doesn't simply withdraw. He continues his battles and, you know, basically goes around the countryside, you know, sacking cities. And those cities that surrender, he treats them well. Those that don't, he treats them very, very poorly. And so he goes for 30 days while he's waiting for them to decide upon his demands, which were unreasonable. He does all that killing to sort of up his power, I suppose. And then he comes back and re-surrounds Rome after 30 days. And on this occasion, a great woman within the city decides, you know, what we need to do is we need to get his mom and his wife and his kids to go begging, not to attack. So this is the famous speech, which I think, I didn't compare the lines, but I think it's word for word what Shakespeare does. So, you know, they're sitting out there in their tents, and all of a sudden, mom and wife and the kids come straggling in, you know, And so what do they say? She says, "My son, even if we were to say nothing, the wretchedness of our dress and our appearance should make you understand in what misery we have lived at home ever since you were banished. But now you must know that we who have come to you here are the unhappiest women alive, for fate has made the sight which you have been the most joyful into the most terrible of all." That fate has made you a sight which you should have been joyful, the most terrible of all. "When Volumnia, the mother, is compelled to see her son, and Virgilia, her husband, turning his arms against the walls of his native city, and even to pray to the gods, which others may find comfort in their misfortune, has become impossible for us, since we cannot ask them in the same breath to make our country victorious and to keep you safe. When we pray for you, we are calling down a curse upon Rome, such as the bitterness of her enemies could desire, and your wife and children are compelled to sacrifice either their native land or yourself. As for me, I shall not wait for the war to decide this issue for me. If I cannot prevail upon you to prefer friendship and harmony to enmity and strife, and thus become the benefactor of both countries, rather than the scourge of one of them, then you must know, and let there be no doubt of this, that you shall never attack Rome, unless you trample first upon the dead body of your mother who bore you. I do not choose to wait for the day when I shall be forced to watch my son either led in triumph by his fellow citizens or triumphing over them. If I were to ask you to save your country by ruining the Volsatians, then I admit, my son, that you would be faced with a cruel choice, since it is neither honorable for a man to destroy his fellow citizens nor just to betray those who have trusted him. But as it is, all we ask is to be delivered from the disaster that threatens us. If this is done, it will prove the salvation of both nations, but it will bring more honor and glory to the Volsatians. They have shown themselves the superior in arms, and this puts them in the position of being givers of the two greatest blessings, peace and friendship, while they themselves will receive no less. If this happy issue comes to pass, you will have done more than any man to bring it about. If not, you alone will bear the blame from both sides. And although the chances of war are always uncertain, this much is sure. If you conquer Rome, you will be your country's evil genius. If you are defeated, the world will say that that to satisfy your revenge, you did not hesitate to bring disaster upon your friends and benefactors." This is a wonderful speech in the play, and it's very dramatic because he's got the entire body of the Volsatian army around him. And here it's this mother boy, who they didn't know he was your mother's boy, sitting there listening to his mom, you know, basically breaking into tears. Mom, don't say this to me. And then he says, Mother, what have you done?" Then he raised her up tenderly and pressed her hand. "You have won your victory," he told her. "You have saved Rome, but you have destroyed your son. This is my defeat, even though none but you could have defeated me." He spoke privately for a few moments more to his mother and his wife, then sent them back to Rome as they wished. The next morning, he marched the Volsatian army out of the Roman territory. Oh, what a disaster. So, it doesn't take long. Well, now at this point, his sidekick, Fabius up there, doesn't take well to this, and he charges him with treason. And Coriolanus is a very good speaker, and he's about to persuade the Volsatians, who are pretty fond of him because he's had all these great victories and brought them all this money. He's about to persuade them morally, but then they decide they're just going to kill him, and so they all jump on him and stab him with a sword and kill him. And he's honored by, he has death with honor, and Rome allows his wife and mother to keep their property and to celebrate, to mourn his death for 10 months, which is a very long time in the scheme of things. Didn't work out ultimately for the Volsatians, because it was a very short time before that Fabius Tullus is killed by and the Volsatians become the subjects of Rome. So this is a story that is told about Coriolanus. Now, let me just briefly tell you some of the points that are brought up by Plutarch in his subsequent essay, which is very short, comparing Alcibiades. Just a brief recollection about Alcibiades. He was the ultimate playboy in Greece. I mean, he was very powerful, very seductive. Everybody wanted to have sex with him, and everybody did. And he was just a wild man. Everybody liked him. He's a great flatterer. You know, he could seduce anyone. When he went to Sicily, and you know, some of his enemies back home got him to be sentenced to death, I suppose, or had some problem, and he decided to go to Sparta, and Sparta and Athens were having a big war, and he helped Sparta and Athens, and then he quit Sparta and went over to the Persians, and then he came back to Athens. So he was all over the place in terms of who he was helping, and he was extremely upset. He was a very seductive man on all levels of life, you know, both politically and in his romantic deals. So anyway, Plutarch has a very, you know, just a little simple essay here in which he compares these people and says simple things like, for example, you know, he says both of these men were very successful militarily, and we can commend them for their courage and commend them for their ability. And then he says, you know, but I, you know, Alcibiades was a flatterer. And, you know, this is kind of sleazy, you know, I don't like that much. But on the other hand, Coriolanus was an insulter. So when he's facing the people, Coriolanus, you know, he calls them names right to their face. And this is the exact opposite from Alcibiades, who, you know, will say whatever is necessary at the moment with the person he is with in order to persuade them. And so this is a very big difference, according to Plutarch, between these two people. And he said, for me, you know, I prefer the flatterer over the insulter. And I, you know, I think that's a good point. I'm inclined to agree with that. Plutarch also points out that the time that Alcibiades interfered with the Lacedaemonian ambassadors, who were the ambassadors from Sparta, who were coming to Rome, and I think I mentioned this earlier, and wanted, not coming to Athens, and they were going to make a deal, and Alcibiades said, don't tell them you don't have absolute authority, you know, and that you have to take it back, and sort of undermined the mission entirely. He cheated them. And so Plutarch compares this with the unfair methods that Coriolanus used with the Volscians to incite war between Antium and Rome. And he says both of these things were quite bad. He blames Coriolanus for attacking his entire country when he should only, the point being, he should only attack part of it, because obviously the nobles had treated him fairly and the common people had treated him unfairly, and he attacked the entire country and he didn't target the person that he should have done injustice to. He criticizes Alcibiades for accepting bribes, and of course Coriolanus never accepted bribe. He was totally not interested in money and refused all the awards. And he accused Alcibiades of being living in luxury and dissipation. He didn't like him for that. Now, the most important point that is raised in the essay that Plutarch has in making the comparison to my way of thinking is he comments that, he says that someone wrote, Antipater wrote, that Aristotle had a great gift, and that he was persuasive. And what Plutarch wants to say specifically about Coriolanus was that he was not persuasive. And, of course, one of the reasons we like to read these things is because maybe we can draw some conclusions about our own life and improve ourselves as a consequence here. And I couldn't help but thinking about people that I know, including myself in some circumstances, who, rather than trying to figure out what your opponent is saying, you know, you're rude to them, or you put them off. And I'm thinking specifically of the way objectives, for example, you know, if you don't toe their line completely accurately, will turn their backs on you and, you know, say you're bad. Libertarians are guilty of that too. And I'm guilty of that when in my French class, for example, most of the people in there have read the New York Times, and they say nothing but a headline from the New York Times. You know people like that that just sort of recount or restate the newspaper, and they're totally uninteresting because of how they have no diverse opinions. It's just, you know, whatever the party line happens to be, and it drives me crazy. And all I can do is, you know, try to restrain myself from insulting them, but I rarely succeed. My point is,
it's a French insult.
I don't know. But so my point here is that the thing that I learned from this is that you need to bring to your relationships a certain degree of humility and a willingness to take a hit and a willingness to try to persuade and not be like Coriolanus and just call your your political enemies bad words. And of course, this is going on in Washington right now. Everybody is in Washington today is basically Coriolanus. All right, so we have learned about Coriolanus. Does anybody have any, you know, personal insights that they might like to share with us, or any questions about what we've talked about today? Yes, sir.
In that incident where the poor people went out on strike, would that have included, you know, the merchants, the traders, the commercial class?
You know, I don't know for sure the answer to that, but I would assume so. It had to have been important. It had to have been important workers, because the Senate was sufficiently distressed that they sent the negotiators out there, made a deal with them, and created the office of the Tribune, which was an enormously important office throughout the rest of the history of the Roman Republic. And so, you know, it was a big deal. So I would assume that the answer to that question would be yes. Any other comments before we move on? All right, I thank you all for coming, and we are going to take a 20-minute break, and then we will have the big show. Thank you.